Is the group known as the Young Politicians of Canada actually a front for NATO? If the Green Party internationally is rooted in pacifism, why is the Green Party of Canada more committed to NATO and militarism? How is spending 5% on defense among NATO allies actually a betrayal of our public's trust? What is the Canada-NATO Parliamentary Assembly, and how does it preempt our ability to form foreign policy independent of what the U.S. wants? This week on the Global Research News Hour, we examine this fundamental push happening towards support for NATO and militarism happening behind the scenes while our planet is facing a host of other problems. In our first half hour, we speak to Alex Tyrrell, leader of the Green Party of Quebec, about a disturbing trend of NATO-aligned entities looking to promote themselves under the guise of civic participation of our youth. Then in our second half hour, we talk to revered peace activist figure Medea Benjamin about NATO's overwhelmingly agreed-to addition of 5% of nations' GDP to defensive purposes. Finally, peace activist Ken Stone joins us to talk about CANA, the Canadian NATO Parliamentary Association, and how it too drowns out Canadian military and foreign policy independence in the waters that power defense contractors at the expense of everyone from the elderly to the next generation. On this week's program, Canada as a nation of peacekeepers, a new generation of warrior youth during massive NATO budget increases. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of July 4th, 2025. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this program was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Ininu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. Reconciliation demands that we not only need to correct imbalances in the present, we should also take into consideration imbalances created through actions of colonialism and genocide toward the indigenous population, which needs to be acknowledged and corrected. Let's put justice at the core of our community of Indigenous people, settlers, and newcomers, and our vision for ourselves moving forward. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. What if President Trump also spoke with Pakistan's President Asif Ali Zardari, a U.S. implant, if Israel uses nukes on Iran, Pakistan was free to, quote, help, unquote, Iran, while Israel was also made aware of this possibility? Pakistan nor Israel is part of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or NPT. What if Trump's idea was indeed to avoid a nuclear WW3 with this maneuver, converting a potential atomic WW3 into a 10-day war? Full stop. From the 13th of June, when the Israeli unprovoked surprise missile attacked Iran, to 22nd of June, 2025, when the U.S. bombing of the three nuclear research sites, Fordo, Natanz, and Isfahan, was done and over. That comes from the article, quote, "What if, unquote, U.S. bombing of Iran was not what meets the eye?" Peter Koenig, by Peter Koenig, posted July 2nd. Given the situation, it is clear that Macron is likely no longer in touch with reality. Reducing the cap on Russian oil prices has no significance for the EU in opposing Moscow as member states can source energy from wherever they choose, which is mostly Russian, but repackaged, especially when it comes to liquefied petroleum gas. LNG comes under labels of a different origin, but is then sold as if it were not of Russian origin, demonstrating how sanctions are largely ineffective. Macron's threat to reduce the cap limit of Russian oil prices is another example of the classic political recklessness that has gripped Europe. Such initiatives have long proven their futility in practice, making it all the more pointless to persistently repeat the same procedure with a negative outcome for the 18th time. That comes from the article, France's threat of new sanctions against Russia. Macron is out of touch with reality, by Ahmed Adel, posted July 2nd. The fact that traditional European rivals and generators of many past conflicts, France and Germany, were co-opted to stand behind the scheme to pool French and West German coal and steel production under a single authority, with suggestions of better things to come in order to foster economic growth and prevent future wars, instilled trust in the cooperative effort. It was a noble-sounding undertaking which appeared to align former rivals and enemies economically, thus eliminating a major root cause of future conflicts. Tight political integration and thoroughgoing cultural reformatting, which was the real objective all along, were never elaborated in detail. Those subjects were discreetly mentioned in esoteric pronouncements that few took seriously. No red flags were raised, however, because for a long time the true objectives of, quote, European integration, unquote, were kept under wraps. That comes from the article, European Union, the Inception and History of a Destructive Chimera, by Stephen Karganovich, posted July 2nd. This week alone, the Trump administration is reportedly erecting protest barricades around the White House. Congress is advancing legislation that favors the wealthy, and President Trump is grandstanding at the opening of a detention center dubbed, quote, Alligator Alcatraz, unquote. Against such a backdrop of government-sponsored cruelty, corruption, and shameless profiteering at taxpayer expense, what, to the average American, is freedom in an age when the government plays God, determining who is worthy of rights, who qualifies as a citizen, and who can be discarded without consequence? What are inalienable rights worth if they can be redefined, delayed, or revoked by executive order? Frederick Douglass posed a similar challenge more than 170 years ago when he asked, quote, what to the American slave is your 4th of July, unquote. That comes from the article, Inalienable Rights in an Age of Tyranny. The U.S. government is, quote, playing God, unquote. John and Nisha Whitehead. By John W. Whitehead and Nisha Whitehead, posted July 2nd. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. There was an interesting article which appeared on the website for Global Green News. That's the source for World Green Party news headlines and commentary. It spoke about something called the Young Politicians of Canada, which presents itself as an inclusive, youth-led nonprofit aiming to foster civic engagement. the authors asserted that this structure was coupled with NATO Canada and other NATO-aligned institutions, suggesting that it is actually a front for countering the currently negative appeal of the military to the youth of today. The article was written by Alex Terrell and Eve Engler. We got hold of Alex to get more details about his research. Alex currently is the leader of the Green Party of Quebec, and he joins us now. Thank you for appearing on our program, Alex.
Thanks for having me.
What exactly made you and Eve investigate the Young Politicians of Canada?
Well, I mean, both Eve and I are very interested in foreign policy and big critics of NATO. And I came across this file because this young person named Jaden Braves is 16 years old right now. He used to be the president of the youth wing of the Green Party of Canada. So I met him about a year or two in that capacity. But then after following him online, I started seeing all of these posts about him being flown all over the world to different NATO meetings, meetings that are aimed at training the world leaders of tomorrow and this sort of thing. And he was meeting with all kinds of Canadian cabinet ministers and pr presidents of other countries, ambassadors, all sorts of things. And it's very odd. One thing that really caught my attention was that at one point he participated in a NATO summit and he released like a little TikTok type of video where he was saying like, as young people, the people who are in this NATO meeting today are taking important decisions for our future and what's our future going to be like 5, 10, 15 years down the road. And you got like tanks like rolling by behind his green screen on the TikTok. So he's basically making the argument that, for the youth to have a good future, that we absolutely have to invest in military hardware and get ready for some sort of a global conflict. So that definitely caught my attention. And the further that we dug into this, the more and more information was revealed, not even really hidden. But this group that he had founded called the Young Politicians of Canada, their number one partner is the NATO Association of Canada.
When you, just in investigating him online, did you like did he have like regular posts, and then at some point this NATO aligned imagery started to prop in there, or was it there? How long until he became this I guess NATO person?
Like the posts about like these NATO meetings and stuff like that started like just shortly after I had met him in his capacity of a youth president of the Green Party of Canada. And so they just started becoming more and more frequent, and like he was reaching higher and higher up like into the NATO organization. And to look into this a bit, like there's basically this organization called NATO Canada. So it's a nonprofit that's dedicated to promoting NATO's mission, like in Canada. And basically, I went to the website of this organization, and the first thing I saw was that they had done a study, and their study revealed that young people were far less likely to support foreign military intervention, U.S. foreign policy, spending on military and weapons, and this sort of thing. So really, the young people are far more favorable to peace than they are to confrontation. And of course, NATO Canada views this as a major problem that needs to be corrected because their agenda is to increase military spending, to get ready for world warfare, and maybe even to provoke some wars to make some money off of. So they view this youth opposition to war and militarism as a problem that needs to be corrected. And they pointed out in their report that if Biden was at all critical of Israel, right, we can debate how critical he was. I don't think he was that critical, but they say that Biden criticized Israel because the young people supported Palestine. And they say that the more that young people, support Palestine and peace and that kind of thing, the more chances there are of some politicians running anti-war campaigns, being elected on anti-war mandates and this sort of thing. And that goes against the interests of NATO Canada. So they came up with a strategy to counter this youth opposition to war, and basically platformed a lot of well, some young teenagers really to be pro-military kind of influencers, right? And so they bring these kids in to different training opportunities and that sort of thing. They have them practice like going to meetings with politicians. They're practicing their social media posts and that sort of thing. And they're creating this narrative online, at least to their followers, that young people, they want more military spending, they want more preparedness for war and that sort of thing.
Wow. So, I mean, this Jaden Brave sounds like he's kind of like a made man in a way, that it's not as his instigation, but like there are people behind him. And I'm wondering, like, who have you identified as some of the influential people in the background?
Well, that's it. Like we're looking through this, right? And so Jaden Brave's founded. He says he's the founder and CEO of this organization called the Young Politicians of Canada, which of course sounds very innocent, right? And this organization has done some legitimate work, like representing youth in terms of giving their point of view on like legislation about online harms and that sort of thing, right? But they also have a national security task force and send people on a delegation to the White House on these fully funded trips and that sort of thing. Jaden himself is just getting back from Georgia right now, where he was hanging out at the Ukrainian embassy. Of course, he speaks in pro-Ukraine protests and this sort of thing. So to get back to who is behind this, they have an advisory committee of the Young Politicians of Canada. One of the people on there is Anthony Housefather, of course, a notorious liberal Zionist MP in Canada. There's also people from NATO Canada itself. And there's also Elizabeth May, who has, some sort of affiliation with Jaden Braves that she's maintained. And really, her presence in that organization gives it credibility that it does not deserve. And it's really unfortunate that these adults are sort of pushing these children to go and join politics, but not really for the right reasons, more for like promoting these NATO interests. And it's dangerous, right? Like the actions of these young people can contribute to violence, right? They can contribute to people being killed in other countries, through a belligerent Canadian foreign policy that, is aligned with U.S. interests and seeks to, do regime change in different countries and really be in a constant cycle of war. So, without really being old enough to create their own opinions about the world and, about what's right and what's wrong and, how can we find world peace, they're being brought directly into this narrative about imminent confrontation.
So it looks like this is sort of an event that they're like this Young Politicians of Canada. It's maybe just one aspect of a more widespread attempt to try to do something about these pacifist youth, as you
Well,
say.
yeah, definitely. I mean, it's only one front organization, right? We don't know how many other organizations like that there are. And I mean, NATO Canada has a youth wing, right? And they've got like 18 young people, their photos and bios and everything on their website. So they're making a concerted effort to try and influence the youth. And I think that if more people knew about this, they'd be very upset about it. But unfortunately, it's not the kind of thing that the mainstream media in Canada is going to cover because they've basically erased any criticism of NATO.
On Monday, the 30th, you and Eve staged a protest, and then a few other people staged a protest in Montreal, and you engaged some of these young politicians of Canada. Could you tell us how that protest went over?
Yeah, that's it. So, I mean, the Young Politicians of Canada had organized a similar event in Ottawa just a couple of months ago, and they had the presence of some federal politicians and ambassadors from Ukraine and other European countries. They've been given a lot of institutional recognition. In fact, Jaden Braves has even gotten the King's Medal. But that's it. So they were holding a similar event in Montreal, and it was kind of sold as voices of the future, a way for young people to talk about involvement in politics and that sort of thing, right? So a very innocent sounding event, right? And so we figured that a lot of people going to this event probably are not aware of the organization's ties to NATO, right? and this isn't some conspiracy theory that we're coming up with, like NATO Canada is the number one partner identified on the Young Politicians of Canada website, right? So it's well-known fact. It's not contested. And so we figured, well, look, we'll set up in front of this event that was held at the Maisons de Développement Durable, a venue which sort of gives a bit of progressive credibility to this event. And we'll hand out pamphlets to the young people as they go inside, warning them about the ties to NATO and warning them what this Young Politicians of Canada nonprofit is really about. So when we got there, turns out we were right. Most of the people going in had no idea that it was affiliated with NATO. And a lot of them were telling us, like, well, look, I'm gonna, as soon as I get in there, I'm gonna ask them about this, you know? So there was people like that. There was also people who were more, a little bit older, you know, the group targets 14 to 24 year olds. So there are some university students that knew about the ties to NATO and, you know, were sort of there for that, right? They want to pursue that kind of career opportunity, I assume. They know what's happening and they're there, you know, with full knowledge of the situation. But most of the younger people had no idea. And so we're handing out these pamphlets as they're going in. And then the reception table, you know, is like having one person after another come in asking, like, what's the deal with NATO? So they got a bit upset. And, you know, the organizers at one point came out and they were telling me, like, if you go inside, we're going to call the police on you. We're going to have you expelled and all this, you know. But, I mean, of course, I've been to many protests before. And, you know, in Canada at this point, we're still allowed to hand out pamphlets and speak our opinion about NATO. So, I mean, I wasn't really threatened by that at all. And we managed to convince a lot of people, you know, and to the point where when they started off their presentation that evening, they had to start it off by saying, well, listen, we are funded by NATO, but we're also funded by all of these other organizations. Of course, that doesn't address our criticism. We don't care about the other organizations. The issue we have is with their affiliation with NATO, which clearly they do not deny.
Mm. And yeah, you also should notice that they did fire back at Eve Engler in particular. Jaden Braves did, and but it was basically an aside, right? It wasn't actually dealing with the core issues.
No, it was just a bunch of insults saying how Eve is ignored by policymakers and this sort of thing, and he hasn't gotten the institutional recognition that somebody like Jaden Braves has got, you know, getting the King's Medal and meeting with all these these high up people and being flown all over the world, this sort of thing, you know. But I mean, obviously, Eve is a thought leader in Canada with respect to foreign policy, and, you know, has been on the right side of many progressive causes and has been greatly influential. So, you know, not only is Jaden's response petty and kind of childish, but it's also completely unfounded. And it, you know, by going into these kind of insults and stuff like that, well, it shows that they don't really have any substantive answer to why it is that they're associated with NATO and why it is that NATO is going lurking around high schools and universities trying to indoctrinate youth into being part of this little influence campaign to build youth support for military spending.
Okay, we only have a couple of minutes left, but I'd like you to address the issue of the Green Party of Canada, because Green parties internationally have roots in the peace movement and a strong commitment to the principles of pacifism, disarmament, and nuclear non-proliferation, but that doesn't seem to be the case with the Federal Conservative Party. And I noticed, for example, Elizabeth May, who was, correct me if I'm wrong, but she's a one of the advisors of this Young Politicians of Canada. And I mean, she seems to be much more hawkish with regard to the Ukraine war, for example, you know, getting at the Russians and so on, and being a little slow on criticizing Israel's attack on Gaza as a genocide. How do you explain, is Elizabeth May's personal influence, or is there something else wrong with the Green Party of the House of Commons, a more widespread phenomenon that's, you know, pushing them in a hawkish direction?
Yeah. Well, look, I've been leading a Green Party here in Quebec for 12 years, right? So what brought me to this was those founding principles that you mentioned about peace and anti-war and non-nuclear proliferation, that sort of thing. The problem that the global green movement has at the moment is that there's been a whole lot of selling out by Green Party people who want to take power, who want to move ahead, and so are willing, not just to parrot the pro-war agenda, but to play an active role in it. And with respect to Canada, as you mentioned, Elizabeth May has been completely aligned with all of the NATO talking points. When people, even her own constituents, complain about Canada, you know, being engaged in this proxy war against Russia, she says that they're brainwashed because they're reading too much Russian media. So that's a big problem. So she was involved with Jaden when he was president of the youth wing, but she also chaired the meeting that he held in Ottawa, and she sits on the advisory committee of the Young Politicians of Canada. So she's completely enabling instrumentalization of this young person by NATO. And I would have thought that she would take some distance, especially after we shared a video of this 16-year-old Jaden Braves literally firing a semi-automatic rifle while leaning on a NATO flag. He posted this on Facebook saying that he was getting some weapons training. Like, you would think that that would be enough for Elizabeth to say, like, okay, you used to be in the youth wing, like when you were 14, 15, but now you're 16, you're like basically a NATO asset, like, you know, promoting weapons and stuff like that, posting footage of yourself firing semi-automatics on NATO flags. Like, enough is enough there. You know, at some point you got to cut the ties. But no, on the contrary, she's signed up to be on his organization, is promoting it, is giving credibility to it, and is really playing in to this image that they want, that they want to associate young environmentalists with a pro-NATO stance. Like, it's completely insane, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's nothing environmentally friendly about warfare or anything like that. But, you know, by hosting the event at the Maisons de Développement Durable, right, a progressive institution like here in Montreal, they're giving themselves that same kind of credibility that they're getting from the association with the Green Party. And it's something that can be used to trick a lot of people into thinking that this is something progressive when really it's a NATO front.
Thank you very much, Alex. I appreciate talking to you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for digging into this issue. And we're not going to let up. We're going to keep protesting the different events they may have and keep informing people about NATO Canada's efforts to influence youth and to undermine youth opposition to war.
That was Alex Terrell. He's currently the leader of the Green Party of Quebec.
NATO partners almost overwhelmingly made the commitment at the NATO summit in The Hague last week to boost spending on the military to 5% of GDP over the next decade. This will be an extraordinary amount, and it's getting high fives from the military contractors on the CBC and other major media, but there have been few voices, if any, recognizing what is wrong with this picture displayed in the mainstream media. Well, we're balancing the scales a little today by bringing in a voice of peace, and her name is Medea Benjamin. She's the co-founder of the women-led peace group Code Pink, and she's also co-founder of the human rights group Global Exchange, also the Peace in Ukraine Coalition, and Unfreeze Afghanistan, which advocates for returning the $7 billion of Afghan funds frozen in U.S. banks. Medea has been an advocate for social justice for 50 years, described as one of America's most committed and most effective fighters for human rights by New York Newsday, and one of the high-profile leaders of the peace movement by the Los Angeles Times. She was one of 1,000 exemplary women from 140 countries nominated to receive the Nobel Peace Prize on behalf of the millions of women who do the essential work of peace worldwide. And she has received numerous prizes, including the Martin Luther King Jr. Peace Prize, the U.S. Peace Memorial Prize, the Gandhi Peace Award, and the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation Award. She's a former economist and nutritionist with the United Nations and World Health Organization. She also contributed articles to global research, including a recent article, NATO's 5% Pledge, an obscene betrayal of global needs. Our interview with Medea Benjamin after a brief break. Don't go away. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour, Medea. It is a pleasure having you with us.
Thank you so much, Michael.
We need a big, strong military so that no adversary will attempt aggression. You know, a weakened defense system might embolden adversaries like, say, Russia or China. Well, what do you say to those sorts of arguments?
I say try diplomacy, that we have been on this militarized treadmill, especially for the last 20-something years in the United States after the 9/11 attacks. And we have found ourselves just looking at every problem around the world from a military perspective. I know in the case of Ukraine, when there was a possibility of a negotiated solution right after that Russian invasion, which was an unprovoked illegal invasion, it was the U.S. and the U.K. that came in and said, no, we're going to use this as a time to weaken Russia. And that war has been going on for now 3 years, and I just think with horror of all the poor Ukrainians and the Russian soldiers who have died because of this. We put way too little emphasis on diplomacy, and it's like former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright once said, if you have this shiny, wonderful military, then why aren't we using it? I think if we had a lot less of a shiny military, we would actually be a lot safer as a globe.
Looking at the picture from the standpoint of realism, you know, there was the commander of U.S. Northern Command, and he was raising alarms in recent months about the disturbing trend of Chinese and Russia sending submarines creeping closer and closer to North America and being able to launch ballistic missiles at North American soil. I mean, what do you say to the thought that Canada especially needs to build up its military to keep up with the threat posed by those countries?
I think the threat to Canada is taking money out of its healthcare system. The threat to Canada is not addressing the environmental crisis. The threat to Canada is not spending its money on the needs of its people. If you look at who is surrounding who, it's the U.S. and its allies that are surrounding the world. I mean, the United States has over 800 military bases around the world. This is just, I think the next largest would be maybe 20 at the most, or 20 total, because almost nobody has foreign military bases except the United States. And the United States engages in these military exercises in the Pacific, in the Atlantic, all over the world that is threatening to other countries. And, of course, China and Russia are building up their militaries to try to compete with the U.S., and it is just such a vicious cycle. There are so many other things that Canadians need and would make their lives better than following the U.S. down this terrible path towards taking so much of our resources out of the people's needs and the climate and putting it into a dangerous game of militarism. And I emphasize that dangerous because, you know, we just saw in the case of Iran how this could have spiraled out of control. Two nuclear countries, the United States and Israel, in a war with Iran could have led to a nuclear war and still could. And Iran probably wants to get nuclear weapons now. So this is a very dangerous game. And Canada should be a shining light for the world to show us a different way, to show us a country that actually does take care of its people and doesn't follow this path to militarism that only leads to war.
Hmm. There's a certain amount of flexibility, right? I mean, because it can include the building of roads and rails and bridges, which and that could, you know, be, you know, sort of dovetailing into the military, because those things aren't necessarily, you know, for malicious needs other than, you know, having to be strong enough to support military equipment or something like that. So basically, the dovetailing of military with public works projects. I mean, could you see, or could we see as citizens a petition of our governments to you know, maybe direct our money in that direction as opposed to you know, more war and military weapons constructions?
Well, first of all, it's ridiculous that there's this international military alliance that is dictating to other countries how much they have to spend on their military. And what you're referring to is that 3.5% is supposed to be direct military investment and the other can be fudge. Well, that 3.5 is extremely high. Most of the countries in NATO still haven't even reached the, quote, goal of 2%. So, you know, the Canadians should decide what Canadians are going to invest their money in, not the NATO generals, NATO representatives who were never elected by anybody, and certainly not by the people of Canada.
You mentioned that that there's the major weapons and defense contractors are making money from this defense spending, right? But are they somehow influencing the perception of the threat against us through money or some other influence? Like, it kind of brings to mind, I guess, what Eisenhower, that famous saying by Eisenhower, you know, beware the military-industrial complex. You know, how do you see them, you know, influencing these aims?
Absolutely. Here in the United States, it's much more overt, the kind of legalized bribery and corruption that exists, because these weapons manufacturers, they give money directly to the campaigns of politicians. There's a revolving door between the Pentagon, the elected officials in the U.S., and NATO, especially people coming from the U.S. So they're all involved in this and make a tremendous amount of money. I live in Washington, D.C., and the richest districts in the entire United States are in Virginia, outside of Washington, where the defense, I call them military, I like not to call them defense, the military contractors are. This is, to me, a total scam. I think Eisenhower would be rolling over in his grave if he recognized just how much this military-industrial security complex has grown since the time he warned us about it in 1961. And I think it does actually push us into wars. And we should be doing everything to stop wars, to get us out of wars, to not get into wars. And yet we have these people whose livelihoods depend on a constant state of war. And I would include the people in NATO in that as well.
You talk about the increase in greenhouse gas emissions from increased military spending. But as I understand it, the military is aware of this, and they've taken some steps to limit greenhouse gas emissions. I mean, they have it in print on the internet. For example, Canada has the Defense, Climate, and Sustainability Strategy 2023 to 2027, which provides direction, and you need targets to improve DND's environmental footprint and response to a changing climate. And in the United States, also released in 2023, you have the Department of Defense plan to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, which aims to reduce greenhouse gas emissions through more efficient technology and reducing operations, alternative fuels, improved data collection for monitoring emissions and help us address them, you know, and pursuing technology innovation and so on. Do any of the studies that you refer to address these sorts of initiatives in the military with GHG emissions in mind?
I think that's so absurd on so many levels, Michael.
Okay.
There's one level of saying, oh, so maybe the people of Gaza would be better off if they were killed by bombs that were produced in a more ecological way. Or maybe we'd be better off if the billions and trillions of dollars we spend on the military were not spent on directly dealing with the planet. I mean, think of all the energy that is wasted in the building of all of these weapons when those factories could be converted into factories producing things like solar panels and windmills and all kinds of new technology that could be used to address the climate crisis. I'm in Washington, D.C. We just had a heat wave of over 100 degrees Fahrenheit the entire week. And a lot of people couldn't even go out of their houses. So we need to use this money and free it up. You know, at these yearly climate talks, they have been promises of $100 billion for a fund to mitigate the climate crisis for the poorer countries. And that fund is never reached. That goal is never reached. Wouldn't it be nice, instead of saying that we need to spend all this money on the military and make the military greener, instead we actually funded these climate funds that were promised to countries that did not contribute very much to the climate crisis, but are the ones who are feeling the consequences? That's where our money should be going.
Yeah. You mentioned diplomacy before, but I mean, in terms of instead of spending on the militarism, spending on peace, what kind of peace projects do you think we should be exploring? I mean, beyond militarism.
Well, I think there could be all kinds of things. We've talked in the U.S. about having a Department of Peace that would be involved in organizing peace gatherings throughout the year and try to avoid wars, that would bring people together who don't talk to each other. And we talked about having real peacekeepers that were not armed peacekeepers, but were people who were accompanying people who are in need. For example, we see in the West Bank how these violent settlers come in to abolish and tear down the olive groves and the homes of people. What if we had hundreds and hundreds of people doing nonviolent accompaniment to show the world what is going on in certain places and shame people and try to stop the violence? So there's all kinds of ways that putting money into peacekeeping could be used to make people who are living the atrocities right now, have them, the international eyes put on them. And then I think shoring up the international organizations, whether it's the International Court of Justice or the International Criminal Court, giving them more resources, making sure that when they come up with reports that these are actually implemented. So those are just some ideas off the top of my head, but I'm sure people who work internationally could come up with many, many ideas to put funds into peacekeeping.
And finally, Medea, I mean, you're with Code Pink, and then they usually have, you know, certain displays or certain functions to bring awareness to certain things and maybe you know, put down the leaders in charge. Do you have anything along those lines in the not too distant future that you'd be prepared to disclose?
Well, we do it every day because we're in the halls of Congress every day. And excuse me if I sound angry, Michael, but I just can't stand waking up every morning and hearing that another 100 people have been killed in Gaza, another a million people are starving in Sudan. The things that are going on in this world are so atrocious, and yet we allow our countries to be involved in funding them. And so I think any country that is providing weapons to any of these countries, and in the case of the United States, you know, we are the number one by far provider of weapons to Israel. And so those in Congress, which represents the overwhelming majority of people in Congress, they're not representing what their constituents want, which is an end to the violence, a ceasefire. They are representing lobby groups like AIPAC. So, yes, we will continue every day to be in the halls of Congress and to be demanding that they start representing what the American people want and not what lobby groups are calling on them to do.
You've been a great help to this conversation, I'd say, balancing the scales. So I want to thank you, Medea, for joining us and participating in this discussion on this very important topic.
Okay, thank you so much for having me on, Michael.
We've been speaking with the renowned peace activist and Code Pink co-founder Medea Benjamin. She spoke to us from Washington, D.C.
Ken Stone is back. He's the treasurer of the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War and also the coordinator of the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network. Good morning, Ken. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Michael. I am not the coordinator. You almost got it perfect. I'm on the coordinating committee of the network, and we set up the agendas for meetings and we plan ahead for Canada-wide actions and activities.
Okay, thanks. Well, you're also a spokesperson, so.
Yes.
Okay. Can you explain a bit about the history of what's called the Canada Parliamentary NATO Association, or CANA, and how its existence may actually worsen the situation from a peace activist's perspective?
Okay, well, CANA, CANA, is the Canada NATO Parliamentary Association. And it is a the largest parliamentary association in the House of in all of the Canadian Parliament. It has over 200 members, and it includes MPs, senators, and Privy Council members. And the purpose of CANA, as stated in its own materials, is to disseminate information, of course, they mean favorable information, from NATO to the House of Commons in Canada. And of course, the NATO, and for Canadian members of Parliament to be plugged into NATO's semi-annual parliamentary assembly. So this is a way that NATO reaches into the parliaments of all the member countries in order to have the parliaments play along with NATO's game. And then NATO's game, of course, is not a defensive game. NATO is an aggressive military alliance headed up by the USA, which laid waste, for example, in the last 30 years to the former Yugoslavia, to Afghanistan, to Libya, and has had its dirty hands in Iraq and Syria as well, and including, thanks to the research done by our own Tamara Lorenz of Kitchener, it has its dirty hands stretched into the genocide that's taking place now at the hands of the US and Israel in Gaza. So this parliamentary assembly, it reforms after every federal election. So the federal election was at the earlier was in I can't remember now if it was in January or February, but 3 months after the federal election, MPs who've been elected get to apply for a spot on CANA, the Canada NATO Parliamentary Association. And this, of course, plugs them into NATO, and from this association, they can get free trips to The Hague and places where other NATO summits are taking place. And so we are, for the first time in that I know of in the history of the anti-war movement in Canada, our network, the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network, has made our intervention into NATO and the Parliamentary Association as a priority, because what we would like to do is put a face on NATO in Canada. NATO is not far away in Brussels. NATO has a bunch of deputies and marshals located in the House of Commons and the Senate in Canada. And what we've done, thanks to Just Peace Advocates, is we sent out a sign-on letter that everyone can sign on to. If you go to Just Peace Advocates, or if you go to the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War Facebook page, you will see the sign-on letter. I know it's there because I put it up last night again. And you can ask your MP not to join CANA. And so far, I think we've had about 2 or 3,000 letters going to various MPs. And of course, there's a copy of each letter that goes to Prime Minister Carney. So we hope we're getting our message across. And our goal is to put a face, as I said, on NATO and show which MPs belong to Kana in Parliament and put pressure on them to get Canada out of NATO altogether. Because as long as we are part of NATO, every time the US goes on the warpath and starts a new war, such as the one in Iran, Canada will be dragged in. And that's not what we want. We want an independent and peaceful foreign policy which cooperates with all the countries of the world.
Now, yeah, well, in terms of just the way you describe it, I mean, I'm reminded of the way how Big Pharma has had a kind of a pressuring role on ordinary doctors, because they lobby them constantly and they have all these influences and give them trips and so on. And I guess it's this is kind of like NATO acting as being able to influence individual politicians regardless of their party of policy. Is that how it goes, or does it go even deeper in terms of gutting our foreign policy, say if we had a government elected on a non-aggressive foreign policy?
Well, I guess the analogy of a lobbying group when you connect it to Big Pharma or the pro-Israel lobby in Canada, that might be appropriate, but this is more formal than that. This is actually a parliamentary association of MPs over, I would say the last term there was over 180 of them and about 20 senators and I don't know, a half dozen or so Privy Council members. So this is more formal than a lobby group. This is actually NATO's tentacles reaching into the Parliament buildings in Ottawa.
Are there any particularly active politics? Because you said there are a whole bunch of MPs in there. I mean, are there any in particular that are involved in Canada that may concern you right now?
There are actually from all the major parties, there are representatives in Kana in Parliament, even the NDP. And I forget the name. I think I can't remember the name of the chair, the past chair under the previous term of office of the of Kana in the government of Canada prior to the election. I think what they're going to have to do when they get together and have their first meeting, which should be in a couple of weeks, is they're going to have to elect a new executive and a new chair. And my understanding is that on the executive serves a member of every political party in Parliament: Bloc Québécois, Liberals, Conservatives, NDP, Greens. So this is a multi-partisan effort on behalf of NATO in order to get the entire Canadian Parliament on side for whatever wars they want to wage. And of course, we let's not forget that NATO puts a lot of pressure on the Canadian Parliament through this CANA, Parliamentary Association, to increase military spending. Canadian military spending at the moment was 1.33% of GDP, $42 billion. After going to Brussels, Prime Minister Carney came back and said there would be unprecedented rises in Canadian military spending. He said by next year, Canada would hit the 2% of GDP mark, which would effectively bring up Canadian military spending to $62 billion. Now, that's an incredible sum of money to spend on the military. And can you imagine, Michael, what $62 billion could do for the problem of housing, homelessness, or education, or health care, or firefighting in Canada? I'm talking about fighting forest fires, about native reconciliation, about getting water, fresh water to native communities in the north. I'm sure $62 billion would go a long way to solving most of those problems, but
You could
instead,
feed and clothe
it's going to
every.
go to military spending. And Carney says that's only the beginning. By 2034, it's going to 5%, which will be $150 billion. And of course, he's already said certain other programs are going to suffer. And guess which programs those are going to be? Those are going to be our social programs. Canadians are going to lose their social programs, or they're going to be so gutted that it'll take you forever to access your doctor or a school for your kid or your, you know, income tax information or anything like that. So this is a very, very worrisome position for Canadians. Or it should be.
Yeah. So I guess I wanted to know, just recently, I was wondering if you could spend just a moment to talk about an event that happened in Hamilton this last weekend. I mean, throwing shoes at images of Mark Carney, President Trump, and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Gorey Park. Could you explain this particular event to our listeners and how it
Yes,
went?
I'd be glad to. Only in the Hammer. Only in Hamilton, as far as I know, of all the places in the world, on this past weekend, which was an international day of protest against the illegal U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran. And our network, the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network, partnered with organizations such as UNAC in the United States, United National Anti-War Coalition, and we called for a weekend of solidarity activities with Iran under the slogan "Hands Off Iran." So every group was, able to make their own decision as to what they will do. And I'm sure some people had a protest along with their regular protests about Palestine on the weekend. And our group, we decided to take a leaf from the famous Iraqi journalist who threw his shoes at George Bush a number of years ago, when just after the U.S. the Anglo-American attack in 2003 on Iraq, which effectively destroyed that country. So what we decided to do was to show our disgust with the war makers, namely Trump and Netanyahu, and with the enabler, namely Carney. And we set up tripods in a park downtown called Gore Park, and we put the big posters of Trump, Netanyahu, and Carney on the tripods, and we invited people to put down $2 as an entry fee, and they got four throws. And we took their best two throws as a score, and we had a competition, and we had a number of winners in the adult and in the child categories, and we had a fun time, and it made it on actually made it onto the local TV station CHCH.
Good.
So it was we felt it was a very successful event.
Yeah, for sure. Ken Stone, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome, Michael. And people can access our website, Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War.ca. They can go to our Facebook page, our Twitter account, and our Instagram account. And of course, the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network has its own social media and its own website, Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network.
Ken Stone is the treasurer of the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War and one of the coordinators of the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network. That is it for another edition of the Global Research News Hour. Next week, we will be discussing the particular role of the media in enabling the genocide in Gaza. Join us then. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show can air on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download on the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.